This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. Today we're hearing from Shasta County, where the first COVID-19 case was diagnosed in the North State. Despite a recent uptick in cases, Shasta County, with cities like Redding and Anderson, is faring relatively well. It is one of the most populated Northern California counties not on the state's watch list. We're going to try to find out why. We're also going to look into the status of COVID-19 testing. Who gets tested, how to get tested, how long it takes to get results, and problems when testing gets delayed. If you have questions or comments for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216. Or you can also head to mynspr.org. For Thursday, August 6th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, some news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The global coronavirus pandemic has infected more than 4,000 North State residents as of Thursday, as health authorities across the 11-county region confirmed another 116 cases. The total now stands at 4,082. North State hospitals are currently treating 80 COVID patients, 11 more than Wednesday. The death toll throughout the region stands at 35. The statewide figure is nearing 10,000. In a possible positive sign, the test positivity rate, measuring the number of tests confirming infection, declined or was unchanged in 10 of the 11 North State counties. It rose in Sutter County to 8.1. Figures vary widely in the region, from 0.7 in Trinity County to a high of 13.4 in Colusa. As far as cases in individual counties, public health officials in Butte County were reporting 1,060 cases Thursday, Sutter County 881, Yuba 553, Shasta 411, Colusa 361, Glen 352, Tehama 271, Siskiyou 90, Lassen 65, Plumas 33, and Trinity County 5. The California Department of Public Health reported 116 COVID-related deaths Thursday, raising the total fatalities across the state to 9,869. In terms of cases, the California Department of Public Health confirmed 5,258 more infections, putting the statewide caseload at 529,980. The 14-day statewide test positivity rate slid 0.3% to 6.1 on Thursday. Although the trend suggests infection rates may be slowing, the actual number of cases could be significantly higher than reported. Data transfer issues acknowledged by the state are giving health officials and the public an inaccurate picture and hampering efforts to trace and isolate people potentially exposed, according to Butte County Public Health spokeswoman Lisa Almaguer. The issue involves errors in automated data sharing between county and state organizations counting COVID infections. A solution is in the works, but Almaguer said, if we're not informed of new cases, we cannot perform investigations and tracing. Helicopters and the familiar blue and white Pacific Gas and Electric pickups will finish up a 5-day drill Friday in the Sierra Nevada foothills in preparation for fire-related blackouts. A statement issued by PG&E spokesman Paul Moreno said improved technology should reduce the length and breadth of public safety power shutoffs this season. The company instituted protocols for severing electricity service to fire-prone areas following 2018's campfire sparked by unmaintained PG&E equipment. The 5-day exercise aims to speed power restoration following a blackout. Every line is visually inspected from the ground or air before being re-energized. Moreno said PG&E aims to cut that time in half and has added more ground crews and nearly doubled the number of helicopters available for inspections. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. The United States is continuing to see large increases in COVID-19 cases. Each day since the beginning of July, we've had between 40 and 75,000 new cases, with around 160,000 deaths from COVID-19 in the United States so far. The U.S. has a little over one quarter of the cases worldwide, while we make up only about 5% of the globe's population. Much of the uptick in the new cases is coming from rural America, places like the North State. Colusa, Sutter, Glen, Yuba, and Butte counties are seeing a lot of new cases and are being monitored by the state of California. But then there are a few counties like Trinity and Shasta that have been doing pretty well at keeping their numbers low. NSPR's Andre Bayek recently spoke with Tim Mapes, Public Information Officer for Shasta County's Health and Human Services Agency, about the county's somewhat low numbers.
Well, you know, we are encouraged by our numbers and the fact that, you know, we are not on that state watch list as of yet. That's an encouraging sign for us, but it's also one of those things that we don't want to get complacent. You can look around at the counties that border us, and many of them are on the state watch list. And it can happen very easily if you become complacent and the gatherings and the precautions that are not taken or that should be taken by the public are not taken. We can see that spike in cases very quickly, and it's hard to, you know, kind of put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak.
Staying with those encouraging numbers, according to the state, Shasta County is both doing fairly well in cases per 100,000 population and also the test positivity rate, which is about 2.4% right now. Can the health department point to any reasons why Shasta has been able to keep those numbers below state monitoring thresholds?
You know, I really do think it is hard to figure that out, you know, because like I said, there are some neighboring counties who are seeing some really drastic spikes. We have seen an uptick recently, and we've had a few notable events, you know, public events that we weren't too exactly thrilled to see, you know, with lack of social distancing and lack of mask wearing, you know. So why our numbers are so much lower than other neighboring counties that are seeing a problem, you know, is kind of a little bit of a mystery. At the same time, we don't want that to lead to complacency. And if we are doing something anecdotally, it could potentially be, you know, I mean, our neighboring counties, our direct neighboring counties are not seeing huge spikes, you know, Trinity, Siskiyou, Lassen, some of those areas. And I think we do reach this area up here where we are a more remote part of the state. So that may be helping out a bit. As you go farther south and you get closer to those metropolitan areas, you know, Butte County, Glenn County, who are really, you know, having a challenge right at this moment, you know, it could be because of that proximity of people being able to travel. But again, that's really just looking at the numbers and trying to make sense of them at this point.
You mentioned that recent uptick in cases. I believe there were about 21 new cases reported over the weekend. Has the health department been able to gain a better understanding, possibly, of where the cases are largely coming from? Maybe family gatherings or outdoor events, like you mentioned, or perhaps other scenarios?
Yeah, our contact tracers have been discovering, you know, through their interviews with people who test positive and their close contacts, that it really does, most of the time up in Shasta County, are stemming from these small family gatherings. The reason that may be the case is, you know, you go to a barbecue or a Sunday dinner, and you get around your loved ones that are you are really comfortable with. And, you know, after a few minutes, you let your guard down and, you know, they're your loved ones. You hug, you haven't seen for a while. And unfortunately, you know, those close gatherings indoors is what we've also been seeing are really the places where things can spread. So really that, we believe, has kind of been the reason for our uptick in cases. We were concerned, you know, about some large gatherings that had happened, but so far at this point, we haven't had any definitive link to those as to a spike in cases. But again, with the time frame, that could still become an issue, and we will just have to see.
I understand the county recently announced that it will be taking perhaps a tougher enforcement posture on violations of health rules. Can you walk me through what the county announced and perhaps what that enforcement strategy is?
Well, we've said from the beginning, we still would rather educate as opposed to enforce. And, you know, we can't say enough about the businesses that are doing everything that they can to operate safely and keep our economy going. You know, mask requirements and all of the safety precautions that they have to take. But unfortunately, even despite the educational efforts and, you know, kind of explaining to businesses that it's kind of creating an unfair playing field if they don't follow the state regulations and then so many other businesses are taking those extra steps. And it's a hardship for those that are doing that. And we understand that and we empathize with that. And you just reach a point where, you know, you kind of have to tell these businesses that it is not an option to not follow these state regulations. They're in place because of a reason. We are in a pandemic, and we need to make sure we keep those numbers down. That being said, you know, our statement that was made was just basically letting, you know, businesses know that we still want to work with you. We have a team from Health and Human Services whose goal is to go out and educate and work with you and come up with a plan to operate safely. And that's what we still want to do. If at some point everything falls on deaf ears, you know, there could be some steps that can be taken by other county departments, state and county departments, you know, because Health and Human Services plainly doesn't have enforcement powers. So ours is the educational aspect, but at some point, since this is a county response, there may potentially have to be some consequences if somebody doesn't want to collaborate.
And consequences, could that be citations or perhaps even fines?
I think what we're looking at right at the moment as first steps, you know, is obviously there's warnings, and that's really trying to explain why we're doing this and why it's so important. I think last ditch effort, there is some movement to where, you know, food licenses can be revoked, potentially business licenses. But again, we don't anticipate that happening, hopefully. We have so many businesses. We have a STAR program that we've called it, and it's a self-attestation where businesses that are doing everything right, we want them to shout it from the rooftops that they're doing it and let their customers know that they're doing it, that they're taking the health and the safety of their customers and their employees to heart. And, you know, they can go on our website that we've created for this response, ShastaReady.org. They're able to post their plan that they've come up with and post something on their front door that says, hey, we're taking all these steps and we really want you to work with us. And we've seen a great response to that.
When you look at the next month or two, what are some of the main focuses of the health department when it comes to perhaps slowing the spread of the coronavirus?
We really are trying to get the message out about what we can do. We do not have a vaccine. We do not have, you know, medical treatments that are widely in use. There's some being studied, and, you know, we all keep our fingers crossed for that. But for right now, you know, what we have is the social distancing, staying home when you're sick, and wearing the face mask when you're out in public. We're not saying wear it 24/7, you know, but if you go to the grocery store, help out those workers who are trying to make ends meet and the people that are there with you shopping. It really is something that everybody can do. We're not on that state watch list. We want to stay off that state watch list. We want to get our kids back into school. That's starting soon. So that's a big focus, is letting people know that parents' responsibility for when students start going back into school is keeping that kid home if they're not feeling well and making sure that they're okay. Because people have made so many sacrifices in the last few months. And if we can do a few of these steps, perhaps we can start working our way back to a little bit more closer to normal. So that's our focus, is getting that message out there. There really are a few things that we can do that can really make a difference in the long run.
That was Tim Mapes, Public Information Officer for Shasta County's Health and Human Services Agency, speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to helping businesses find high-impact hires who can make a difference by offering tools like screener questions and sponsored jobs. Learn more at indeed.com/high-impact. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com/2-week-challenge.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Tire Rack, offering a selection of tires, shopping tools, and user reviews to help people find the right tires for their car and driving conditions. Learn more at TireRack.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource committed to offering inspiration and information about what works in K-12 education. More at edutopia.org. From Subaru, through the Subaru Love Promise, Subaru and its retailers have donated more than $28 million to the ASPCA and local animal organizations. Subaru.com/pets. and from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Matt Fidler. Getting tested for COVID-19 was not much of an option for most people when the pandemic first hit. But in recent months, that's changed. Late last week, after feeling somewhat sick, NSPR's Angel Haracha decided he needed to get tested. And all he had to do was Google COVID-19 testing Butte County, which directed him to the testing webpage where he selected an appointment. He said it was quite easy.
Last week, over the course of 4 days, a few mild temperatures, the beginning of a cough, and difficulty breathing, I decided to sign up for a COVID-19 test. This past Monday, I arrived at the testing site at the Chico Fairgrounds. I was stopped at the door by an employee covered in gear that included a face shield, mask, gloves, and a medical gown. I presume I was the very first guest of the day. I set up the appointment 3 days earlier online and picked the earliest time. After providing my confirmation number, I walked over to be greeted by two more men in protective gear. They asked me questions regarding my symptoms and so on. At this point, my anxiety kicked in. I was a little embarrassed to feel this way, but honestly, I still had no idea what to expect. Was the test gonna hurt? Did they suspect I had the virus? I looked over to the testing station covered for privacy with signs that said no photography without permission. This was not time for a selfie. Finally, I was called over to the testing site. I sat down in a chair and the employee handling my tests directly addressed my fears. She told me to relax and not to be nervous. I have massive anxiety issues, so this was comforting and helpful. She told me to drop my mask to expose my nose but still cover my mouth. And then she slid the swab into my right nostril. Honestly, there's no other way to describe it other than jumping into a pool and having water go up your nose so far it makes you cry. She then swabbed the second nostril. After a few seconds, I exited the building and it was over. They said my test results should be in about 4 to 6 days.
That was NSPR's Angel Haracha recounting his experience getting a COVID-19 test. In some locations, it's hard to get a test. In others, supplies are an issue. And yet in others, it takes so long to get the results, by the time they're available, the person who got tested may have already started to spread the illness. To try to better understand what's going on with testing and why, North State Public Radio's Mark Albert spoke with Elizabeth Rosenthal. She's the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, a nonprofit news service covering healthcare policy. He started by asking her to confirm if the wait time for test results locally, which is between 6 and 16 days, is fairly typical across the country.
Well, it seems to be, but it's kind of catch as catch can, and that's a big problem. You're going to be lucky and get your test result in 24 to 48 hours, which is possible, or whether you're going to get tested for something that's you really need a test result for, and you won't get the test result back for 14 days, despite often promises that, oh, this is going to be quick. And that leaves people kind of paralyzed.
Why is it so important for the results to come back quickly?
It depends what you're using the results for, right? If it's someone who needs surgery the next day. I often joke that the best way to get a quick test is to be scheduled for an elective knee replacement the next day, because then it's in the hospital's interest to do a really quick turnaround so they can get you into the OR for a high-priced surgery. Being admitted to the hospital, you want to know if they're COVID infected because you want to put them in a certain kind of isolation. For critical workers, for example, people who work in a nursing home or assisted living place, you don't want them bringing COVID into the nursing home or assisted living. Schools are about to open. You really want to know if students are COVID-free before they infect classes and teachers. It's important to have a timely result in some cases because you need to act on it very quickly. If someone's sick with COVID, they get certain treatment. But in other situations where we do see long delays, it's pretty disastrous because if you're testing everyone to see whether it's safe to go back to school or safe to go back to work, what are they supposed to do? Sit there for 14 days and wait for a result? The alternative is that they go in and as many people now who are getting COVID tests think, well, it's going to be likely negative. But what if it's not? Then you've exposed a whole classroom, a whole nursing home. So it's really vital that we get these test times down and standardized.
But aside from the anxiety of not knowing what the result's going to be, how is that really different from what people generally should be doing anyway? Avoiding others, maintaining distance, wearing a mask, and that sort of thing.
Yes, it's good to take precautions, but there are levels of precautions, right? I wrote for the New York Times the story about how I had my kids come meet me for a beach vacation, right? And I had them get tested before they came down because they had participated in some protests in New York. And it made sense. You know, we wanted them to not have to wear a mask when they were around us. So if you're going to visit an older relative or someone who's immunocompromised, you really want to know if you're COVID positive or negative because it will impact the way you behave. And likewise, if you work in a nursing home or an assisted living place, it really does impact how you behave. You go to a different level. If you're positive for COVID and you work in those situations, you should not be going to work. All the precautions we can take while they're important for those, well, probably not positive cases or negative cases. If you are positive, they are not enough. If you are positive, you need to isolate.
Issues with testing have pretty much been with us throughout the crisis. I'd like to go back a few months, almost to the outset of the pandemic, at least in the U.S. Tests were in very short supply, and regardless of the president's statement that anyone who wanted a test could get one, people really couldn't. Why?
The initial reason that this was a new virus and they needed to develop tests, then there were a series of missteps and bungles. The first tests, which we knew worked, were distributed not to the hot spots, but kind of randomly to federal health centers around the country. Then we found out that one of the reagents in those had been contaminated. Then, you know, a test is not like one thing. You need swabs, PPE, you need the right reagents. So it was like saying, oh yeah, we sent you a computer, but we forgot to put in the keyboard. It just was terribly coordinated. And part of the problem, frankly, is that in many other countries, there's been a national testing strategy that was tightly coordinated and choreographed by the central government. In the U.S., the administration's answer to this was, every hospital, you figure it out. Every state, you figure it out. And it was really an impossible task because you had these poor, you know, sourcing people in states and in hospitals often competing with each other for swabs, for reagents, who has the tests. And this was as the number of tests was ramping up. So, you know, places that thought, oh my gosh, maybe we will get COVID even if we don't have it now, they ordered a whole lot of stuff. So New York, where there was a lot of COVID, couldn't get the amounts they needed. It was really, really a total mess and continues to be, but in different ways. Now, there's a lot more testing out there. There are a lot of testing sites. It's easier to get a test, almost too easy, one could argue. But then you can't get the results. So what's the point of having a test if you don't know what the results are for 10 to 14 days?
That was certainly something that was going on at the beginning of this crisis, where there was sort of rationing of tests for quite some time. People were denied tests unless they could say they had traveled to China. And that was after it had already become fairly well established here in the U.S. Now, at least in California, there was talk recently of having some restrictions on who could get tested just so that they could reduce the wait time. Is there a right answer here?
Well, I think one thing we could ask is, was the notion that anyone who wants a test can get a test the right thing to be saying, given this was a new virus, a new test, and we knew there were shortages. We don't say anyone who wants a strep test can get a strep test. You have to have a reason to want a strep test. So I think, you know, where a number of places are heading now is, okay, let's think, what are the priorities for testing? So obviously people who have symptoms, people who need them for work, have had exposure and want to make sure they haven't converted to positive, acquired the virus, people who want to protect relatives who they're visiting. So, you know, maybe there will be a point, and there should be a point, where we can say, oh, anyone who wants a test can get one. But I think what we need to do right now is say, anyone who needs a test, who has a good reason to have a test, can get one. So I think we have to be smart about how we use testing, given that at the moment, we clearly don't have the capacity. Now, and that's a second question, which we should talk about, is why don't we have the capacity?
That is a good question. Initially, the issue was tests. Now the issue is labs and not being able to process the incredible volume of tests.
So if you say everyone who wants a test can get one, the capacity to stick swabs up people's noses galore in many cities now, there isn't the back-end capacity to process them. But if they can't promise you a 48-hour turnaround, why are they doing it? And that's what we're seeing now. You know, they take in a lot of swabs, send them to these big labs that just don't have the capacity to process them. If we're going to test, we need to get results back in a timely manner.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. Delays in testing have also touched you personally. In an op-ed you wrote for the New York Times, you described a trip full of precautions, anxiety, and uncertainties, and as it turned out, it was all thankfully over nothing. Can you describe your experience a little, and if you feel comfortable, speculate on the outcome if perhaps your son turned out to be positive and you and your family were maybe a little less cautious?
Yeah, you know, I'm a physician. I consulted with a friend who's an infectious disease doctor, said, we want to have a nice beach vacation with my kids who are in their 20s. They both participated in protests in New York. And, you know, we had an elaborate strategy of this is the day they should get tested. We'll have them wear masks and take precautions until the tests come back negative. And, you know, they were both guaranteed that the tests would come back within 48 hours. Well, my son, when he came down to meet us, having taken elaborate precautions of, you know, masking, sanitizing to get to the beach, still didn't have a test result. So we were lucky. I had rented a COVID-era friendly house that had a little guest cottage out back with a bed. So I said, until your test results come back, you have to stay out back. We didn't hug. He didn't participate in cooking dinners. At meals, we had to eat outside, and he sat at the far end of a picnic table, and we squirted ketchup on his burger for him. His test result didn't come back for 12 days. By day 10, I knew he was no longer infectious, so I let him take off the mask. So we acted as if he could be infectious the whole time, so there was no harm done.
That's Kaiser Health News Editor-in-Chief Elizabeth Rosenthal speaking to NSPR's Mark Albert. Mark and Elizabeth went much deeper in the extended interview, which is available online at mynspr.org. And that's your program. As always, if you have thoughts for us or want to share your experiences with this pandemic, you can leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or on our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Helen Barrington, Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Rodeville, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. I'm Matt Fidler, the technical producer here at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Thanks for being with us. You can tune in each Thursday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following Friday morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.